Welcome to our second event lecture. So we've been sitting here on the topic of food and faith. It's one that obviously I know with Lent, kind of starting with pancakes and ending with Easter eggs. I was thinking today it's just a perfect kind of topic for Lent, really, so we can think about what we're giving up. But I'm sure that David, with his kind of background on the environmental side and
food and few years ago, probably 10 years ago, I was heading up the environment work in the Diocese of Bath and Wells. I was a vicar of four parishes, but as an add-on, I was chair of the Diocese and Environment Group. And one of the things that that work made me do was to address a whole lot of questions about us, God, the world, what we're doing to the world. But also, I found myself thinking about the question, not just what do we need to do about climate change, about pollution, about all these things, but what kind of people do we need to be? What sort of characteristics do we need to have? It's an old way of coming at these kind of things. St. Paul talks about knowing someone by their fruits. Jesus talks about bearing fruit in terms of the character of the person. And for a number of years, I've been coming at environmental issues from that angle, and I'll come back to that in a minute. But the way I've come at this thinking about food is related to that. And let's start with some food. I brought my shopping basket along, and we'll start out with a little bit of something to eat. So, scissors needed. Just come prepared. Right. Raisins. Here we are. We'll pass them around. Take a raisin and pass it on to the next person. Don't eat it. Not yet. Just hold it, have a look at it, and have a good look at it. Have a good look at your raisin. Turn brown. Look at the colour. Raisins are brown. Everybody knows raisins are brown. But have a good look at it. And you'll find that it's actually all sorts of different raisins. And some parts of it are flat and shiny, and some parts of it are rough. Some parts of it might even be gold sort of colour. The texture of Thank you. You can probably still place it. Can you still place it? So if you swallow it, you can still place it. Now, that was all from one razor. Think how much food you've eaten today. Think how much food you've eaten in the last week. Think how much food you've eaten in a lifetime. I wonder how much of that you really tasted and you really felt, and how much of that you really looked at. Think what you missed. I wonder whether you ever get to the end of a meal and you sort of don't remember eating the meal because you've been too busy talking to somebody or listening to the radio or reading your paper or reading book or whatever else it is. And yet, food with its taste, its smell, its texture and so on is just so rich. In the book of Genesis, chapter 1, that opening poem of creation, God calls the world into being and he sees that it is good. One of the things that looking, smelling, or feeling slowly in a focused way can do can give us a sense of wonder at the world. Just think how much taste you've got from one little razor. And yet, you just eat these things. And sometimes we eat these things very quickly. I remember a bloke coming around from the meal with us once. He was, when I worked up in the Midlands, and he was a diocesan officer. And he came over to see me about something or other, and we invited him to have lunch. And so we had lunch, and he sat down and had lunch. And you know, my wife was there at lunchtime. It was me, her, and it was me, and it was in the eating. And I was just about moving on to the second potato. And he finished. It just shoom, gone like that. You know, if he made a noise, I thought he was a vacuum cleaner. Nobody wanted to. Shoom, food's gone like this. I thought, well, whether he tasted it. And yet, sometimes I'm aware that I can get towards the end of the meal and not really taste it. And yet, food is so important for us. If we give food time, look at it, we can be pretty amazing. There's a sense of wonder. If we get time with our food, it can be one of the things we do often, eating. One of the things we do because we have to do. And yet, if we slow down and give food time, then that can affect us not only at the meal, but the way that we do other things. There is an old word, simplicity, which doesn't mean being naive. It means being what you are, who you are, in your place, and in tune with how you are and the world is. And food, how we eat, can help us develop that. But there's one other thing about food as well. Where is your razor now? It's in there somewhere, okay. And let's not go into too much detail, okay? But it's being churned around there in the stomach with all sorts of juices, and there's bacteria in there, friendly bacteria in there, that are churning things around and digesting that. And what was that razor will become part of you. That is already part of you. If you've got on the scales, you weigh the razor as well as you. It's already being digested, it's being a part of you. You are made up of all the things that you've eaten and what you breathe. I'm making an assumption here that you're all breathing. Is there anybody who isn't breathing? Okay, you're all breathing. Is there anybody who hasn't eaten today? Okay, you're all eating today and you're all breathing as it goes on. And what happens? You eat the food becomes part of you. Waste matter then goes passed on. We won't talk too much about that, but you know what I mean. Okay? Air. You sit there, you're breathing. You're taking the air into yourself. And that oxygen gets some of that oxygen through your lungs, gets into your bloodstream, becomes part of your body. It's going around you, becomes part of you. And as you breathe out, some of the old oxygen that's been in there, that's been converted down to carbon dioxide, gets breathed out. And we tend to think of ourselves as us. As us, as me, as you, as other people, as other things out there. And we can easily tend to think of ourselves as an entity. We're actually an open system. We're actually always, we're connected with the world, not only through our touch and our sight and our hearing, but through physical matter. Matter becomes a part of us, and then we become a part of the world. And we as people are part of the world. We're not in the world, we're part of the world. In the book of Genesis, in chapter 1, God calls the world into being. He makes animals, he makes humans. Food is mentioned. He gives them food. Because food is so basic. Food is essential for life. Without it, we don't survive. That's how we are. Having food, eating, is a part of what we are. We are made of what we eat. And through the Old Testament, there are, in the books of the law described, there was the practice of sacrifice, where something like the first of the harvest, or something like the best lamb in the flock, was taken and was offered to God. Part of it would have been burnt, part of it would have been eaten. One of the things that that was doing was ensuring that the people did not take food lightly. It was a serious business. Food is always serious, as well as a joyful business, if you live in the kind of society where you are producing your own food. And where if you don't produce your own food, there's nowhere else to get it from, because you've got to get it. That was the kind of society of the Old Testament, the early days. But food is a serious business, and it's so easy for us to take it for granted. Because it's there in our shops. To the extent that when you can't buy an iceberg lettuce in February, they call it a crisis. I mean, can you imagine anything more daft? But people do think it's a crisis. They can't get their strawberries for Christmas. That's the kind of culture we live in. It's so easy for us to take food for granted, but we got it. And it's going to be there. Not only is food going to be there, but what we want is going to be there. The only controlling factor is whether we can afford it. It's going to be there. It's easy to take it for granted. Three things I think we need. This is just the start. One is, in the world, a sense of wonder about the world and how the world is, and food can help us generate that. Just appreciate it, give it time. Another thing I think we need is a sense of simplicity, being in the world, being in the present moment, not just living in the future and living in the past, but living now where we are. Food can help us do that as we attend to it. Third thing I think we need is a sense that we are a part of the world, and food can continually remind us of that. We're part of this world. Let's look at some other things. Where did they come from? Well, I mean, you got it from me, that is a short answer there. Ah, nobody thought of that one. Well, I'm going to look on a packet. Anybody think of it? You tell them. Gateshead, but they don't grow sort of raisins in Gateshead, I know that much. I can tell you that, I've been there. Right, don't know where they came from, we can only guess. I wonder how many people were involved in producing your raisin. Somebody grew it, somebody harvested it, somebody was involved in drying it, it was packed, it was transported, it was shipped. A lot of people, isn't it? The tea that you drink. Do you listen to the food programme on radio before?
Yes.
I hear it sometimes. It was on tea, wasn't it? Last Sunday it was on tea. I only heard a bit of it. I was doing something else. My wife cooks and she was doing dinner and it was on. I heard bits of it there. And there was a very poignant bit where the bloke who was presenting the programme was interrogating somebody who owned a tea plantation about the conditions that these people who pick the tea were having to live in. But it wasn't this tea, because this is fair trade tea, and I know full well, because it's got the fair trade mark, that the people who produce this get a reasonable return for it. But I wonder how many people. Every time you drink a cup of tea, you are linked in with dozens of different people. And every time you eat a banana, you're linked in with dozens of people. The people who plant the bananas, who look after the bananas, who harvest the bananas, who are involved in shipping the bananas, who are working on the docks. And what's life like for them? I would. Even if it's a fair trade banana plantation, these ones come from Colombia. That's a long way, isn't it? Sugar. Cane sugar. That's pretty tough work as well, working on a sugar plantation. Wonder what sort of life these people have. Look. British girl. Wonder what sort of return the farmers get. Wonder what sort of life the cows have. Breaker. Wonder what sort of life the pigs have. Wonder what sort of death the pigs have. Could have been a lot worse. This came from a butcher in Oak Hill, and they source their stuff locally. This comes from Palestine. Some friends of mine were in Palestine recently, and they were working with a farm there in Palestine to planting olive, small olive trees. Because the olive plantation had been destroyed there, and they were planting another one had been destroyed by the Israelis. And they spent several days doing that. And once they'd done it, the Israelis came in and chopped them all down. And there we are. And the coffee. You can go on like this, can't you? And I don't know whether it does anything for you, whether you begin to get the thing, just shut up about this. I like to just drink my tea without thinking about it. I don't want to think about the people who harvest the bananas. I don't want to think about the cows. I just want to drink it. Shut up. But sometimes it's worth doing that. Sometimes it's important to do that. And what that does, when we start thinking about these things, is we can begin to feel some compassion. That means, compassion. Compassion is just feeling with the other people who are involved in these things. And compassion is fundamental to being a Christian, because compassion is part of the character of God. And if we're going to be Christian people, then compassion is fundamental. But it doesn't stop there. Compassion needs to move on. So let's move it on. And you know this, I don't need to spend much time on this. In the book of Exodus, chapter 3, God speaks to Moses in the burning bush. And he says to Moses, I've heard the cries of my people in Egypt, his compassion, and I have come to rescue. And that is justice. The story of the slaves being liberated from their slavery in Egypt is a story of justice. Justice in the sense that the word is used in the Bible. Sometimes justice is not particularly the best word, because for us justice means weighing things up in the balance and giving everybody a due. But justice is a major theme running right through the Bible. It's there in Exodus, it's there in the book of Judges, where people rescue the Israelites from their oppression by the whoever it is, Midianites or Philistines or wherever it is. When you've got prophets like Elijah who come and challenge King Ahab, you've got it there in somebody like Amos who says there's justice rolled down like the waters. It's there in the book of Micah, where Micah says that God has shown you what is necessary, which is to love justice, show mercy, and walk humbly with God. It runs through into the New Testament, because where Jesus there comes to somebody who's pushed on the edge of the society, and through healing them or pronouncing forgiveness to them is able to bring them back into the community, then there is God's justice at work. It's a strand running right through it. And it relates to food. Food can, in us, generate compassion, but also we need to think about our food in terms of justice. Justice for the people who produce it, rather getting them a decent return, are able to improve their situation. For the ground, the animals, for everything else, all that's involved in the process. If you think of the opening chapter of Genesis, you know the story, the poem. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The earth was without form and void, and darkness was on the face of the deep. The Spirit of God was moving over the face of the waters. God said, "Let there be light." And there was light. And God separated the light from the darkness, and the light he called day, and the darkness he called night. It was morning, it was evening, it was the first day. And it goes on over a sequence of days. And then on the sixth day, God says, "Let us make humanity in our own image." So God made humanity in God's image and gave them dominion over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air and the animals of the field and over everything. It's important to think what that phrase actually means. The key image there is the image, or the key phrase there is the image of God. Humanity is made in the image of God. And it's a phrase which has been used time and time again in Christian thinking. And people have thought being in the image of God can mean a number of things. One of the things, one of the ways that people sometimes think about it is God is powerful. So if I'm going to be being godly, it's going to be being a powerful person, being able to do things, being able to manipulate the world, maybe manipulating that power over other people. Or God is creative. So being godlike is going to mean being a creative person, arty person, whatever. Or God is intelligent, so it's our intelligence which reflects our being the image of God. And I don't know whether you've read into this stuff, but actually that phrase, image of God, carries a lot of baggage down through the centuries. But one of the interesting things about it is that it is so rare in the Bible. It is there at the beginning in Genesis 1. And it crops up somewhere in the book of Leviticus. And that's it. Until you get to the New Testament, and then the phrase crops up twice in the New Testament. Once in 2 Corinthians, and once in the Paul's letter to the Colossians. And on both occasions, the writer, St. Paul, says, Jesus Christ is the image of the invisible God. So what does it mean to be in the image of God? One thing it's going to mean is an image. What does an image do? An image shows what something is like. So being in the image of God means that if we are that, then we are to show the rest of the world what God is like. What is God like? God is, as we see God in Jesus. Being in the image of God means being like Christ, who is fundamentally one who cares. That's your title. Who cares? Answer? God. Second answer? Us. Hope. Because if we are followers of Jesus, if we are to be in the image of God, we are to show the world the care, the love, the concern, the passion for justice that God has. And in doing that, we're going to be going against the stream, because there is so much in our culture and our society which is not based on care, it is based on exploitation, it is based on getting as much as you can for the limited amount of input. It's sometimes said that in order to feed the world, we need to have these developments in agriculture, we need to have big agriculture, we need to have genetic modification. Sometimes having a big agricultural outfit might be more efficient than having a small one, but that's actually highly questionable. What a lot of this is about is actually about power. A lot of the stuff about genetic modification is actually about power. Because the people who develop the genetically modified seeds hold their patent on the seeds, and they also hold a patent on the other things that you need to put into the soil to kill off the weeds and so on. And that gives them power, and power gives profit. There's one example of failure to care. You don't look far in our world to see whether it fails to care. Lack of concern for justice. One is the simple obscenity of the fact that there are billions of people in the world who have inadequate food, when there is adequate food in the world, and there are also billions of people in the world who eat too much. It's absurd, it is unjust, the whole thing is out of kilter. And it's not people showing the care and compassion of Christ, not a world, a way of ordering the world which reflects Christ's concern and God's concerns. It's something which is about self, what I can have. So where does that take us? As we think of ourselves and other people, one thing we need, and the food can do for us, is engender a sense of compassion. Compassion can lead us on to working for justice. And we can think what we buy, and we can choose what we buy, on the basis that as far as we can work it out and understand it, it is actually just. It is good for the people who are producing and transporting and working with the food. And sometimes what it calls for us, for from us, is a change. A change in our way of doing things. The traditional, old-fashioned term for changing our ways and doing things differently is the word repentance. Repentance does not mean beating ourselves up and feeling bad. It means changing. It means doing things differently. And one of the things that we need to do from time to time is think about our way of living. And today, this evening, we're thinking about food, our way of eating and our way of buying. And ask ourselves, do we need to change? how we eat, what we eat, and what we buy. You don't get it perfect. There's always sorts of compromises there, but it's something to stop and think about. Here's a little acronym that can help you. It was developed by Christian Ecology Link a few years ago. They're now known as Green Christian. They used the slogan, use your loaf. All over the phrase, we said that when I was a kid down in the southeast of England, use your loaf. It's got me rhyming slang, isn't it? Use your loaf of bread, use your head, think. That's what it is. Use your loaf. Go for food, which if you can is local, which is organically produced, which is animal friendly, and which is fairly traded. Can't do it all the time, but it's something to aim at. Use your loaf. Go for something that's local, organic, animal friendly, and fairly traded. That's what I'm thinking of. And so the thing to do sometimes is just to stop and think. The food that I buy, the food that I eat, am I using my loaf? Is it L-O-A-F? Also worth thinking about is when I have my cup of coffee, somebody calls round. What happens when somebody calls round? So, would you like a cup of tea? Would you like a cup of coffee? Even if you just had one, you still say, would you like a cup of tea or a cup of coffee? Because that's what we do in our culture, isn't it? Some cultures, you give people food. In our culture, you say, would you like a cup of tea or a cup of coffee? Or if you go to the right place in the evening, they say, would you like a beer? Okay? So we offer somebody a drink. And that's good. That is good. Are we also offering hospitality and help and a welcome to all the other people who've been involved in it? Because you didn't grow your coffee. You didn't transport it. You got that from somewhere else. What about the other people? That's worth thinking about too. We thought about food and ourselves. We thought about food and other people. Now, what about food and God? Well, you know what's in here, don't you?
Bread.
Yeah, the bread. Let's put this at the front. This is the thing. And you're not going to get a prize for this, but can you guess what else I've put in my basket? Yeah, of course I have. Here we are. There we are. Right, bread and wine. For most of us, bread and wine are at the centre of our worship. On Sunday, maybe every week, maybe once a month, some people every day. We have a service where we have bread and we have wine. Sometimes the bread's disguised, isn't it? It's turned, it's a little white wafer. Doesn't look much or taste much like bread, but that's what we get. Okay, church I go to, that's what we get. I prefer something like this, but there we are. Nearly said it's a matter of taste. It's also a matter of theology, actually, because I like my bread to be bread, because it reminds me of my link with the earth. It's made out of grain, grew, it's ripened in the sun, grew and swelled with the rain, was then harvest, and this one's baked in Bruton. But bread is basic. Give us each day our daily bread, we say in the Lord's Prayer. Or give us the bread for tomorrow. Give us the basic things that we need. When we take the bread in the communion, it's not just an ordinary meal. Because in that meal, we break the bread and we remember Jesus. We remember Jesus' offering of himself. We remember Jesus' suffering. We share the bread. And we're part of that whole process of what God does in Jesus, in offering himself, suffering, dying, and rising again. And we have wine. which in the communion is reminds us of the blood of Christ, because Jesus said, "This is my blood of the new covenant, which is shed for you and for many for the forgiveness of sins." But wine is also for special. When I was a kid, we used to have one bottle of wine a year. On Christmas, we had a bottle of wine. Sauternes. I think I've sung that. Now people drink wine a lot, don't they? Loads of people, some people drink wine now and that every day. Actually, back in Jesus' time, wine was special as well. I mean, they didn't have beer, as far as we know. We don't even have beer. There's no record in the Bible. But wine wasn't a basic drink. The basic drink was water. That's what you drank when you were thirsty. You drank water. I mean, they used to, back in this country, 500, 600 years ago, they used to drink beer all the time. Small beer, didn't have much alcohol in it, and it was that's what they used to drink. But you don't need much malt in order to be able to make beer, but you need a lot of grapes in order to make wine. So in Jesus' society, in an Old Testament society, wine was actually special. It wasn't your ordinary drink. It was a special drink. It was a drink you had in celebrations. And so, the wine in the communion reminds us, well, it challenges us in some ways, because there's the bread, which is the basic stuff that we need for life, and there's the wine, which is the stuff of celebration. Can we celebrate when there's so much happening in the world which is painful, which is unjust, which is destructive? Can we still celebrate? And there are millions who are hungry, and the climate is being changed, the soil is being polluted, and when the deserts are growing, and species are becoming extinct, can we still celebrate? And the answer is yes, we can. We can celebrate, because Jesus not only died, but Jesus was raised from the dead. Jesus is alive with the life of God. And that is the process by which God works. God works by taking the sin, the pain, the grief, the destruction into God's self, and out of it bringing new possibilities. That is how God continually works. And though often we look at it, we can't see how on earth that is going to happen. Perhaps on earth it isn't going to happen. But it is going to happen. Because that is what God does. And so we remember the basics, and also with the communion we celebrate. We trust in God for the basic things we need in life, and we trust in God for the future. And we have hope. But one other thing to add. No, two other things to add. One is that when we come to think about food and us, we can food, particularly the bread and the wine, can help us in our relationship with God. Strengthen our faith, our trust. Encourage our hope as the wine reminds us of the celebration of Christ's resurrection. We need to have faith. We need to have hope. We need also to have, before you get there, another thing we need to have is wisdom. When was the last time you heard somebody use the word wisdom? Probably a while ago, unless somebody used it in church. It's not a word we use, is it? There are lots of clever people and skilled people and articulate people, smart people. We have wise people. And yet you go back through the Bible, go back through the Old Testament, time and time again the word wisdom crops up. Wisdom is something that people in ancient societies sought. They looked for it because wisdom is about living rightly in the world. And that involves attending to the detail and having the big picture. So there's a question to ask about something we... Okay. Is it wise? Is it wise to eat that? Is it wise to buy that? Is it wise to live this way? Faith, hope, wisdom. Last thing in the basket. Bar and chocolate. I love chocolate. And this is one of my favourites. Actually, I don't know if you know this one. I quite like the milk chocolate. I quite like a creamy chocolate with a hint of subtle flavours to it as well. I won't say too much, you'll start thinking I'm a chocoholic. I reckon it's one of the best ones there is around, actually. It's a Co-op's cheap and cheerful, fairly traded milk chocolate. It's great. I love chocolate. I love my wife. Not in the same way I do not want to eat her. Today's the 14th of March. The 14th of March is my friend Steve's birthday. Steve has been a friend of mine for nearly 50 years now. And, do I love my friend? Yes, I do. Anything bad happened to him, I'd be really hurt. And as you probably know, in the Greek language, there are different words where we could use the word love. If some of you said they love chocolate in Greek, that's the word story. If they said they loved a man, said they loved a woman, then the word there would be the word eros. And if somebody said they love their friend, the word there is philia. And when Jesus says, repeating the Old Testament, that you must love God and love your neighbour, he doesn't use the word storge or the word eros or the word philia. He uses another word, as you probably know, and that is the word agape. Agape is not being fond of something, being attracted to something, it's eros. Or being really friendly to something. Agape is looking for what's good in the other person and doing what's good for the other person. It's the kind of way that Jesus lived, and that's what we're commanded to do. And notice, that's what we're commanded to do. Is there anybody here who doesn't like chocolate?
No, not milk chocolate.
You don't like milk chocolate?
Plain chocolate.
Okay. You don't like milk chocolate. Fine. I'm safe there, you don't like milk chocolate. Now, you don't like milk chocolate. Now, if I told you very severely and very crossly, you must like milk chocolate, you would make the slightest difference with it. Because you like it or you don't like it. And me telling you to like it, me commanding you to like it, like milk chocolate, isn't going to work. It doesn't work. In a similar way, the attraction between people doesn't work by being told. It's something that happens. Friendship, you can say to little kids, you know, go and be friends, but friendship grows. And yet, the kind of love that we're commanded to have is something we're commanded to have. We're told to love. And that's because it's not about liking. It's about something we decide to do. So when it comes to love and food, it's not just a matter of what we like. It's a matter of what we decide to do. Which takes us back to thinking about what we eat, thinking about how we eat, and deciding to eat this and not that, but deciding to eat this way and not the other way, deciding to buy, to use our food in ways that are good for other people. It's something we have to put our minds to and make decisions about. Because love involves using our minds and making decisions. So, food can be there at a pivotal point as our relationship of us as an individual as food and how we eat food, buy food, treat it, smell it, taste it, look at it, can affect the person that we are and the person we become. But food is also something that's at a focal point in our relationship with other people. what we buy, what we eat, how we share, how we treat other people. And food also be a focal thing, a central thing in our relationship with God. We're going to break now. We're going to have a coffee, because that's what we do. What I'll do is I'll give you one of these, okay? This is the thing I promised at the beginning, which gives you an overview of what I've said. At the bottom of it, there are several resources mentioned. One book that I mentioned there is, I've got a copy of it here. This is not for sale, this is my own copy of it, but you can have a look at it if you like. Cold and Touch. I don't know if any of you have come across Cold and Touch. He's a biologist, writer, very good writer. He's written loads and loads of things. But there's a thing here called Good Food for Everyone Forever. Worth looking at. Colin Touch is a firm conviction, and he convinced me that big agriculture and so on is not the way forward, but we can produce enough food for everybody on the planet through what he calls real farming. So that book's on there as well, if you want any of that title, that is down on there. A book by Tim Gorringe mentioned on here. The other book that's mentioned on here is a book that I wrote, which is not particularly about food, but it's about our relationship with God. It's about these things like wonder and humility and simplicity and justice and so on, based not on thinking about food, but thinking about a journey. And that's a book called Love for the Future. And I've got some copies of it back there, and if you'd like a copy, you can have a copy. That's fine. All I ask is £10. So we'll take a break now, have one of these, we'll take a break, and then we'll come back and we'll have a question and answer session. Is that right, Donna?
Yeah, that's good. Brilliant. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Really, you got me thinking there, and particularly a reflection on the bread and the wine and looking at it in a different kind of way. So, do have a think and jot down those questions that you might have. And we'll come back again in about a quarter of an hour, just past half past. We get back together again, and that'll be really good. Thank you very much, David. So yeah, do take a look at the books at the back as well.
Doing what we can first thing I would want to say. So whilst I would advocate the acronym, the idea of going for food that is local, organic, animal-friendly and fairly traded, let's not beat ourselves up if we're not able to do it. And certainly let us not point the finger at people who are not doing that. Okay, that's the first thing to be said. Second thing to be said is that, as one of the questioners pointed out there, if somebody is poor, if the way that things are at the moment, if somebody is managing on a very low income, it would be sometimes extremely difficult for them to buy, say, organic food because it is more expensive than... It's not inorganic food, is it? Because all food is organic. But food that is not organic and so on. So for some people, buying that is going to be extremely difficult. And that's a great shame. What that calls for is those of us who can to try to make changes within our society so that the price of these things comes down. One way that we can do that is by actually those of us who are able to afford these, buying these things, and therefore encouraging the producers to produce stuff. I mean, obviously, if you've got something where there is a limited supply, if lots of people go for it, it pushes the price up. But in fact, with something like food, there's a limitation on the amount of land, but it's a question of land can be transferred into organic production from mainstream production. And if there is a market there, then farmers will actually change. So that's one way, by doing this stuff, we can encourage things to broaden out and the prices to come down. And in fact, for say, for organic food, in many respects, prices have come down over the last 15 or 20 years or so because there is a bigger market there, more people are wanting to buy. So that's the second thing I want to say. A third thing I want to say is that I think that we need to look at, we all of us need to look at the business of food, and we are being led by supermarket chains and others into believing A, that food ought to be cheap, and also to believing that the cheaper we can get it, the better. Food is the most basic thing that we have in our lives. Why on earth should it be cheap? Why do people go for food, I got this and it was, a cheap thing, but it might actually taste pretty awful or not taste good, when by paying a bit more, we can get something which is better. We're into a culture where the mainstream culture is that it's about feeding yourself, having a thing is what everybody else is having, the Big Mac or the Super Big Mac or the, oversized raincoat or whatever it is, that kind of thing, that's the thing you're going to be having, because that's the thing that's being promoted, rather than thinking in terms of quality. It is a cultural thing. Now, the situation has changed. I mean, in other countries I know, Nigeria, because I lived there for 3 years, and France, because I go there quite often. I mean, it is changing in France, but certainly until recently it was the case that French people on an equivalent income would spend more money on food than we did in the UK, just simply because they valued it, because that was just part of the culture. They wouldn't, whereas our culture is to spend as little as possible on food, that gives us more money to spend on what? On music, entertainment, other things we don't need, this, that, and the other thing. Why not put a premium on actually quality food and be willing to spend more on that because it's a good thing to have and so on? So I think that's another issue there. Obviously, there are people, I've got a fourth thing as well, there are people who are on a really low budget, who who are simply buying the food they can, or getting the food they can, because there are some people on maybe low budgets who are in a situation now where they're having to go to food banks to get their food. I mean, that's an atrocious situation to be in, but that's part of that whole economy, and that's something that needs addressing. So that is a bad situation that ought to change. Everybody ought to have enough income to be able to buy decent food. That's the first thing. But a second thing is to encourage it. Those of us who can afford to, need to look at it and say, well, why don't we spend more on food? And so encourage the production of quality food, rather than being, you know, led down the idea that, you know, you can get it as cheaply as possible without people thing. The fourth thing I want to put in here is that there are a lot of people in our society who could eat better food more cheaply if they knew how to prepare it. And that was built into one of the questions, if people knew how to prepare food. There was a time, and I remember it well, 60 years ago, when, you know, people used to be taught cooking and that kind of thing in school. I doubt if that is the case now. It's being pushed out by all sorts of other things. I wonder whether this isn't actually a task for the churches. You know, back in the 19th century, when there was a big missionary movement and people went to Africa and India and these places too, and they took with them not only the gospel, but they also took with them some skills that were worth having. Some of them were skills that were not worth having and were extremely unhelpful, but some of them were things that were worth having, and they shared those. Now, we're now in a situation where we've got millions of people in our country who cannot prepare basic food. And I wonder whether one of the things that is part of the church's mission is to help them to overcome that. And in some cases, it does happen, where people run food preparation and cooking courses and things like that. Bread making. Bread making is a wonderful thing. I don't know if you've heard about that. And I've got a friend who was involved, worked in Liverpool there, and she every Tuesday afternoon, skill that they developed, but it also built that fellowship and was part of that church's mission. And during the course of kneading the bread, I mean, I've made bread, and maybe you make bread, you particularly do it by hand, you do it knead, it's such a wonderful kind of thing. When you've got a group of people that are living together, you've got conversation goes on, and people open up in a way that they wouldn't do if they were just sitting on two chairs facing each other. You know, so things like that, using food as a way of, as part of the church's mission to go out fellowship.
Yes, certainly recognise teaching and talking and singing all go together, don't they really? Yeah. And that's quite a cool there out in this country, crazy that people are hungry. I guess a sort of a change in topic, but on a personal level, do you ever fast? Do you think there's a benefit in fasting? Can you mention that so much?
No, I didn't mention that at all, and yet it's strange.
And I guess it's one of these things where, yes, you can't really ask people, but do you ever fast?
Do I
ever
fast?
Well,
no, I don't. Not in the sense of going without food for long periods of time. I don't do that. For various reasons, one of them is metabolic. I don't have diabetes or anything like that. But I do have a digestive system and waterworks which doesn't do well if I go for periods without food if I don't eat regularly. I not only get ratty and irritable, but also, for me physically. And I can't see any value in making myself ill. You know, what's it going to achieve? And so on. Whereas for people who can. I think that the benefits of it are people say that if you fast over a period of time, it helps clear your mind and so on, and that's good for prayer. People tell me that, and I don't doubt it. That may well be the case. I think what's also the case is that going without something then makes you appreciate it more. And when you actually come back to having it. I mean, on the Lent when I had gone without chocolate, I really appreciated it more when, you know, Lent when I go with chocolate.
That's
about
the funniest,
a common theme. That's a common theme, there is that one. What there also is that, in terms of the kind of thing, I think of Jesus and his disciples being criticised because they didn't fast. And Jesus said about when the bridegroom's with them, you don't fast, but time will come when they will fast. I lived in Nigeria for 3 years. I was a school teacher in a secondary school in the middle of Nigeria. And one thing that happened when I came back was that I swore that I would never again take it for granted that I could hold a glass under a tap, put water in it, and drink it. Because you couldn't do that in Nigeria. We had to boil all that water. And for 14 hours of the day or more, when you opened the tap and the water came out, we had to store it because the water wasn't on all the time. And sometimes when it did come through, it was a pretty horrible cover anyway. In fact, it took me, I remember having, I'd been back about 3 weeks, and I had taken a drink of water out of the tap, and I realised I had just taken it for granted. It didn't take long to slip back into it. But that's, I guess fasting is something like that.
Yeah, it can be temporary or a pattern of life.
It can be that life, but also it can be necessary because of something else that you are called to do.
And then another one, should Christians be vegetarian?
There are a lot of, to my mind, Christ, I'm a guru. Should Christians, I'll just tell you my, my view on this one. I'm not a vegetarian, okay?
I'm just
bacon, yeah. Yeah, bacon, yeah, we're good. Yes, I'm not a vegetarian, but I don't eat a lot of meat. I can cook and live my life away for weeks at a time, and obviously I'll buy the food in my car. Generally, my wife does that. She likes cooking, she loves cooking, she does it very well when I wash up. That's how we do it. Okay. Generally, that's the rule. Occasionally, I cook a meal more often than not. We go to the pub. if it's my turn. So, what was the question again?
How is it your turn to cook?
Not
to
be.
Could you
be vegetarian? I think I'm not a vegetarian, but we don't need a lot of meat. I think there are a lot of good reasons for being a vegetarian. One of them is that, in terms of producing protein, which we need, then you can produce more protein per acre of land if you do it by producing protein-rich vegetables than you can be producing meat. Mm. So it's actually a more efficient use of land. I think that's one thing. Another thing is to do with animals and how animals are looked after, and how animals are slaughtered, and so on. And also, particularly pertinent, is how animals are transported. There was a time 30 years ago when animals were never taken far to the abattoir. Now they're taken vast distances because of regulations, which were not the European Union's regulations. They were actually British regulations. They were British interpretation of EU regulations, which was different from everybody else's. Which meant that small abattoirs were generally closed down and the big ones remained, and animals were transported long distance, which is very stressful for the animals as well. So you've got to think about animal welfare, that comes into it as well. So why am I not a vegetarian? Arguments against it, one of them is the fact that as human beings, we're actually omnivores. We can digest meat, and our physiological system is geared up towards digesting meat. That's sort of how we are. So we can cope with small quantities like other reps. They're also omnivores. But there's also the other thing about land as well, land use. If animals, but if the land that we have, there's some of the land that we have in this country, which you can't grow vegetables on, but you can, or grain on, but you can actually produce good animals on. You can run sheep.
The uplands of Wales.
The uplands of Wales, the uplands of Wales, the uplands of Scotland, the Lake District, places like that. You can maintain the land by running sheep on them, or running or cattle. And if you're going to have these animals, then it makes sense to eat them as well.
Yeah, so it's not a sort of simple theological answer, it's the practicalities of all.
Well, that's what I come at it. I mean, some people, I mean, I've got friends who are vegetarian, and they would give me a good, heavy going on why being a vegetarian is the right Christian response. There's plenty of morality, but I'm not one.
Well, I guess to finish up, there was an element of just talking earlier. It was a query about the connection with the island community and how does that work with getting food to the island? And maybe you can say a bit about your connection with Iona as well.
Right. Okay. The island community is a dispersed community. We don't all live on the island of Iona. It began back in the 1930s with a group of people going out to the island of Iona in the west of Scotland and rebuilding an old abbey there. The idea was not just to get the old abbey built, but the idea was to get people who were training to be ministers in the Church of Scotland working alongside and labouring for skilled craftsmen, and so building a bridge between these two social groups. That was the idea of the experiment. Out of that project came a community of people who have a commitment to each other and a rule by which we live. But we live all over the place. And I live in Castle Carey in Somerset. And I never have lived on Iona, but I've been a member of the community for 20 years. I go to Iona, this little island in the west of Scotland, just about every year for one reason or another. And I will be up there in July, running a course, working there for a week, and so on. On the island of Iona, now, so back to the community, I mean, one of the things the Iona community does, we are committed to working for justice, peace, and care for the world that we're part of. And we take our food quite seriously, in the kind of ways that I've been talking about here. Now, when you come to a place which is a small island in the west of Scotland, if you're running residential centres, and we run two, one at the Old Abbey and another called the McLeod Centre, and in the peak season, when we're fully booked, each place would have 50 guests, as well as a resident group. You've got to feed them. You cannot grow that food on Iona. You cannot grow that food on Mull. So we bring food in. But what happens is that on Iona, our food that we cook and offer the guests, and we tell them this, is largely vegetarian. There'll probably be two or three meals a week which include meat, but that's all. Otherwise,
that's vegetarian. That sounds like it's well thought about.
Oh, it's definitely well thought about. Vegetarian is one. Locally sourced if we can, but there's not a lot of local source apart from fish and sheep.
Lots of mussels.
Don't sell mussels there. But we also go to seasonal food. So, during this time of year, there'll be a lot of root crops as well as green crops. So we have another centre on board where we have some polytunnels, and it's amazing the stuff you can grow in polytunnels now. So we have polytunnels and we have those. You may not know, but they actually grow tea in Scotland now. I don't know whether we've got a community member who grows tea on the island of Mull, and it wins prizes. I don't know whether we're really in the area or not, but there we are.
Now there's a dilemma. Fairly traded or locally sourced tea.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you for explaining your connection and how things work out in the community.
I don't know if we've got time, but is there anybody who'd like to have just come out with these answers? I'm very uncomfortable with being asked questions, you know, coming out with an answer as if I'm the oracle, and then we're just sitting there and listening to it. So is there anything in what I've just said that anybody wants to say, well, hang on a minute, what about this? Yes?
Yes, I asked a question about should Christians be vegetarian?
Yeah.
I hate to say that I'm not vegetarian either.
Yeah.
But I remember that in Genesis 1:29, it quite clearly shows that man was initially created as vegetarian.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering whether in fact there is a theological argument.
Well, Whether there is a
theological argument.
Certainly a theological argument for being a vegetarian, and some Christian vegetarians would point to that passage. They would refer to that, but they would then also say that it's later superseded. I mean, the whole of the Old Testament law, for instance, includes slaughtering animals left, right, and centre. You know, so they certainly weren't vegetarian then, but those there in that narrative at the beginning of Genesis chapter.
And certainly God sent them quails. They must have got quite tired of quails.
Quails and manna must be quite boring, really, but there we are. And they started lamenting, didn't they? They wanted to go back to Egypt where there were cucumbers.
Never grateful, were they?
You mentioned about the dilemma between being able to afford fair trade stuff and organic stuff. Although personally I don't think fair trade stuff is much more expensive.
No, it's not fair trade, is it?
Organic is. Yeah. Generally. But the other thing is that with supermarkets and so on, because food is so cheap now, and it was well mentioned about the fact that we spend a very small portion of our disposable income on food relative to what we could do or what the value of food is. And supermarkets, of course, also encourage waste by doing lots of buy one, buy get one free.
Yeah.
That generates waste because what we really want to do is I'd rather buy one for half the price.
Yeah.
And then not waste the food because food, you put it in the fridge, it gets wasted, people throw it away.
I think the buy one, get one free, a lot of the supermarkets have stopped doing that now.
Yes, but it's still around. They do, but there's no doubt about the fact that some supermarket practices do generate waste. Because the supermarkets are generally, they all have their ethical policies. If you get that PR person in, they'll tell you how wonderful they are. But the basic thing is, they're not concerned with reducing food waste, they're concerned with selling it, okay? And if they can make more money from selling stuff and something's wasted, well, so be it, because profit is what it's about. Good.
Okay, thank you for opening up the role, Husky. And you'll be around for a bit of time now?
Yeah, I certainly can be if people want to comment. Can I just say, one or two people have bought copies of the book. Let me just tell you what it is. But it is the themes that I was talking about here related to are developed there. But they're developed there not in a sort of reflection or meditation on food, but on the basis of a journey, which is a walk from Shropshire in the Midlands up to Iona some years ago, and reflections on that. But the book also, as well as talking about things like humility and justice and so on, the book also has in at the end of each chapter has resources, discussion questions, Bible study, information, and things like that. So it's a study book as well as a narrative.
Yeah, I recommend it too.
You recommend it?
Situation that faces us here now with that situation. So it's going to be quite